somebody from Texas to speak to us since we're in Texas. Dr. Tom Isaacite. My apologies. I met Tom a little while ago, and he's from Canada, and so I'm impressed that he has made the trip down and has become a Texan and has learned about cotton coming from Canada. So this is going to be great, and he's going to be talking to us about managing cotton root rot. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, thank you. I realized when I put the title together, it's a bit Texas-centric. People from, say, Georgia and Mississippi might be thinking of something different. So I'll do a little bit of preliminary explanation of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about cotton root rot. This is a soil-borne fungus disease. The pathogen name is Phymatotrichopsis omnivora. And this is known as, in Arizona, they call it Texas root rot. In California, they call it Ozonium root rot. It's also known as Phymatopsicum root rot, but this is quite different than, say, a lot of root rotting like Rhizoctonia or black root rot caused by Flaviopsis. And this is typically what you see. All during the growing season, you have a field that looks really good, and it looks like you're going to have a bumper yield. And then shortly after flowering, you get a heavy rainstorm or an irrigation, and then all of a sudden in patches, cotton plants just start dying, and they're totally dead within days to a week or so. This is cotton root rot. Some other pictures of symptoms, early wilting symptom, and probably one of the earliest symptoms you might know is by touching the plant. If you feel it, you'll feel, compared to some other plants that are not infected, the leaves are warmer, and this is because the root rot is interfering with the xylem, so the natural transpiration that cools the plant. So these plants are hot. They'll shortly wilt thereafter. And then after, with this picture on the left showing a wilted plant, that would be dead in about a couple of days. You can also, when you pull up the plant, see a covering on the outer part of the plant with fungus. Strip away the bark, you can see that the plant is very quickly killed to the extent that the upper part that's not even colonized by the fungus is still green. But essentially it causes a root rot, which leads to some degree of yield loss, varying from a little bit to total yield loss. You might be able to see evidence of the actual fungus in the field, in addition to what you might see on the cotton plants, in the form of spore mats. And these are typically seen after a big rain event or, say, flood irrigation or such. And it's kind of a slimy thing that it dries down. Dry portion there shown in the upper right side. And this fungus, in this structure, you have spores of the fungus formed. And these spores don't do anything. They don't cause infection. They don't spread. No one knows why they occur. It's just a good way of diagnosing the disease, particularly if you have the problem in trees and you don't want to dig up tree roots in the middle of August when the disease tends to hit. Closer up in terms of the diagnosis, the fungus produces strands of the mycelium, the growing structures of the fungus seen on the surface of the root. The ultimate diagnosis shown in the right is microscopically you have what's called cruciform branching. And this is totally diagnostic for this fungus. Other pathogens do not have this sort of structure. And this is in cotton, it's pretty easy to diagnose. You have areas of plants that wilt and die very suddenly, and you can pretty much diagnose as just seeing these structures there. But in terms of the many other dicot hosts, like grapes, for example, it's a little trickier, and you'd need to see this cruciform branching to have the absolute definitive diagnosis. There are molecular techniques for that, but it's just 2 minutes with a microscope, and it's done. Quick overview of the disease cycle. I did mention it's a soil-borne fungus, and it survives by resting structures known as sclerotia. They're long-lived, and they exist very deeply in soil, 1 to 3 feet deep. And these carry over from year to year. When they germinate, the fungus grows in strands and which kind of explore the soil. And once they hit a root, they start growing on the root. If it's a dicot plant, you have extensive root rot developing and you see the symptoms, and then that leads to further sclerotia production. However, in the cycle of this plant, you can also have monocots, grasses, sorghum being infected as well. They're not symptomatic. They don't really succumb to it. There might be a little bit of root rot, but this infection also allows the fungus to reproduce. So this is why crop rotation or fallowing for long periods of time will not work. This fungus always has that capability of persisting in soil. And again, in the center of the photograph, I have spore mats. That's a part of the disease cycle. It's a total dead end, doesn't do anything. So where does this disease occur? Here's a map. It was taken out of a review article. The shaded areas of the southwest United States, most of Texas. So the unifying features here are alkaline, very calcareous soils with high average winter soil temperatures. So in other words, East Texas and areas east of that have alkaline soils. Fungus is not present there. And in the high plains of Texas, where most of the state's cotton is produced, alkaline soils, but it's too cold. So it's primarily a Texas problem, but it does exist in New Mexico, and it's a bit of a problem in Arizona and even in some eastern portions of California, and of course in adjacent parts of Mexico as well. This is the worldwide distribution. There's been claims that it exists, has been found in other parts of the world. That's never been documented. For some weird reason, it's just here, and it's not spreading. If it's not moving, it's pretty much where it is or where it was hundreds of years ago. They only discovered the presence of it through cultivation of soils when they started colonizing further and further west, and by exploring it with susceptible plants is how they found it. And it pretty much stays in those spots. And even in the fields, it's in very discrete spots. The size of the spots might vary from year to year, but it always comes from those particular spots. So in addition to the direct loss of the plant of yield from dying either before it produces bolls or some points afterwards, it does cause an indirect loss through decreasing fiber quality. So typically the plants don't fully mature. Also, growers that have extensive amount of root rot, they cannot use a picker. They have to use a picker instead of a stripper, which increases the harvesting cost, and so there's a little bit of a problem. And stripper harvesters are very prone to clogging. As strippers go through, there's no roots holding those plants in. It yanks up, clogs the strippers. And I've been in trials where I've seen growers go through the field, and every so often they have to stop and clean out the strippers and move on. So I'll do a very quick review of control approaches. First of all, there's no host resistance, and I don't see it coming down the road. Now, over the decades that people have been looking at the disease, they see these dead areas in the field, and then they see green plants surviving there. And they think, aha, it's resistant. No, it's not. It's susceptible. It escaped for some reason or another. But there's apparently no host resistance in cotton plants. Some of the strategies that some growers have used is to either have a late or an early planting to try to avoid the highest soil temperatures at the time of flowering. It doesn't work for everybody, though. Crop rotation. This is something that's been researched early on. This is still today a standard recommendation, but it is not a complete control. The fungus will persist. It has a very wide host range of dicot crops. Monocot crops are the only option. Like I said, they will become infected, but you can still get a crop out of that. And this diagram here is like just a portion from an extensive, about 12 to 15 years crop rotation experiment. It shows the periodicity of the disease from year to year. Essentially, whatever you do won't matter. Back in the late 1950s, they came up with deep plowing. This is a scientific basis there that if you're getting a lot of the sclerotia buried deeper, you can reduce the amount of infection. Think about it. You do not want to have that kind of machine ripping through your field. So that's not a viable option. Soil amendments were looked at very early. Manure works. Addition of organic matter. But you have to add tons of it. Some growers do this, but it's not very many. Sulfur is also good. It changes the pH, makes the soil more alkaline. But you're looking at tons of sulfur per acre of soil. It's not feasible. And, of course, there's some bad ideas. Salt back in the 1890s, which got revived in the 1980s briefly, and also putting crude oil in soil, not a good idea. So fast forward to the present, pretty much, and I'll skip over the early history of fungicide experimentation for root rot control and get to the work that we've done. And I've been for more than 15 years doing testing for cotton root rot control, and I didn't have an experiment station access for plots with the root rots. I had to go to grower fields, and probably the breakthrough collaboration came with Rick Minzenmeyer here shown on the right, and we got access to a farmer's field. On the left there is Doug Wilde, son of the late John Wilde, who gave us this land to do experiments on, and it had drip irrigation so we could do the testing. And what we came up with in all the screening, and I won't go through all the negative results, was one particular fungicide, flutriafol. When we applied it through the drip system, it controlled the disease. It's pretty dramatic to see all these green plants and then flanked by rows of dead plants. Fast forward to now, this fungicide, which is currently marketed by FMC, is on the market for cotton root rot control. It's applied at 4 to 8 ounces at planting, but there's other options, which I'll go into in a bit. It needs water to activate the fungicide and move it around in the soil, and that increases the efficacy. And it's pretty interesting because, again, let's back up here. I'm talking about a disease that really hits when the plant is in flowering or thereafter, and you're putting out a fungicide to treat it at planting. So this, and you don't really need it during that period of time. You just need it later on in the season. So we have, in this situation, a long-lived fungicide that survives or lasts, persists in the soil during the growing season. So with respect to the water part of it, ideally, if you applied it at planting and you had some germination, some emergence, and then received your rain shortly thereafter, that would give you the best opportunity for this fungicide to be most effective. Under drought conditions, for example, less than 2 inches of rain after a month, this is not really good for the fungicide to work. On the flip side of that, if you planted it and very shortly before emergence you received some sort of rain, there is a risk of phytotoxicity, which is really a dire thing. And to that end, I know that in some areas growers will plant dry and then water it up. Well, growers that are using this fungicide, TopGuard Terra, should never do that. They should never plant and then water up. So the two primary at-planting application methods are T-band, shown here on the left, where there's a spray of this broad area of soil that's opened up following the opening of the furrow, and also a modified in-furrow technique shown here, kind of a splitter to put the fungicide around the seed, and trying not to get the fungicide directly on the seed. So in a T-band cross-section, what you have is the seed of the cotton seed surrounded by fungicide-treated soil. With the modified in-furrow applications, which will probably work better with a dryland situation, what you want is a minimal contact of the fungicide with seed. Here is one example of a possibility, the Schaefer Rebound seed cover. One of the things it does, it has larger orifices, and we have seen or had anecdotes about clogging of these things with planting operations, although I've even seen this thing get clogged, and that can be an issue. In fact, how do we know that TopGuard works for growers when they've had problems of clogged nozzles? And you can see here, this is one photograph, just kind of random as I'm driving through central Texas. And to the row, you can see those green rows. That's where the fungicide was applied. And you see the pattern of the dead rows where the fungicide was not applied because of nozzle clogging. So the considerations for application, the soil type may affect the rate needed, and I've not really looked at this too much, but in Arizona, apparently they can get by with lower doses of TopGuard than in Texas, differences in soil type. The in-furrow application would probably be better for dry land situations than a T-band application. And there may be interactions with fertilizers that are done at planting. Typically, the company does not recommend a fertilizer being applied at the time of planting if there's any salts in the soil or if there's some issues with seed vigor. So, I alluded to this earlier, the phytotoxicity problem. Here's one example. This was a field that was treated with approximately 6 ounces with a rebounder, and after 3 weeks, and you can see in the foreground of the photograph little strips of green showing the plants coming up, and then you see blank areas of the field where the plants did not emerge after 3 weeks. And this being South Texas, it does not take 3 weeks for cotton to come up. It pops up pretty fast down there. And we looked at the field, dug around, and pretty much the seedlings had germinated but had failed to emerge. And in fact, in laboratory experiments that I've been doing to try to understand this problem, Top Guard does not inhibit seed germination, but it does reduce the root length, the weight, and that amount varies from 0 to 68%. I've seen some variety differences, but not enough I could say that there's some sort of issue with that. And it's not just cotton that's prone to this problem. Looking at sorghum, for example, this is one case where we applied, did an in-furrow application with sorghum, and then right after the last seed packet was dropped, we got about an inch of rain. And you can see very clearly the controls which grew and the ones that did not or grew sparsely were Top Guard treated. And in contrast to that, I had another field planted with the same plant or same varieties except a very heavy dose of Top Guard. In that case, the rains actually came at the same day, so those plants were planted 3 days earlier and everything came up, even with that higher dose. So it's definitely has a lot to do with a very sudden rainfall prior to emergence. So in addition to at-plant applications, there's been some additional label changes made. First of all, growers can apply the fungicide through the drip tape. This makes sense. This is what we first discovered works. In that case, so the drip tape needs to be under the plant. We did our experiments with drip tape that was buried about a foot deep, and it won't work with drip tape that's in between rows or running perpendicular to rows. Another option is to apply it pre-plant, up to 3 days before planting. And I'm a fan of this, but not all growers want to do that. There's also, at planting, you could, instead of putting it in the soil, you could put it as a band 3 to 4 inches behind the press wheel, or later on, you could apply it over the top in a band to 1 to 2 leaf cotton, or as a directed spray to 2 to 4 leaf cotton. So again, with the pre-plant application, and this is an example of the knife we use to inject it in, it must be on the planted row. You can't be offset, and it's effective from about 2 inches deep to about 6 inches deep. One example of one of our experiments, the two rows were treated pre-plant 31 days prior to planting, and you can just see it just cutting right through that area of root rot. Growers have been making their own modifications. This is a photograph of one particular implement growers were using to spray in the fall above drip tape for control of the disease. Other options are still available. Post-emergence application, for example, dragging this Y drop along the plants. But the thing is, and I have to emphasize this, the chemical needs to be placed very close or right up against the plants. We've done many experiments with side dressing and they don't work. So here's also the key about the production strategy. Crop rotation is still important, and of course this leaves monocots. I'm concerned about fungicide resistance. I don't think it's likely to happen. I won't go into explanations why, but it's based on how this disease works and this type of fungicide. But the thing is, I'm concerned that growers think that, well, we have root rot under control, we can monoculture. Well, if you look, if you think of Dr. Foskey's talk there, that's not a legume. That's cotton root with root knot nematode. That can be the consequence of monoculturing, and that sort of thing is more difficult to control. Other ways, growers. Here's some aerial photographs taken by Dr. Cheng Hai Ying at the USDA, and they had mapped out fields with root rot prior to the advent of TopGuard in anticipation of it. And with their techniques, I mean, you can just treat root rot areas and save a lot of money. So as far as the future goes, I've also been looking at safeners. So far, I've not found any. I know FMC is interested in a slow-release formulation. This would be perfect for preventing any kind of phytotoxicity problem. And there's also been talk about instead of treating the whole row, just doing a discontinuous application in the vicinity of the seed. So back to that phytotoxicity problem revisited. The grower that had that phytotoxicity problem, well, not all the cotton died, but here in this picture on the right-hand side shows the area of the field that was not treated with TopGuard. And to the row, you can see the benefits of the TopGuard treatment. So he was a believer in the effectiveness of this fungicide. So with that, these are the collaborators that have been there for all of this, the development of this fungicide. And, of course, I acknowledge the grower cooperators, field assistance, and other support. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.